Welcome to America's Disappeared. My name is Gary Eidelberg, your host, and today we are honored and privileged to have two gentlemen with us. Vance Bartley is a paralegal. He works for the firm of Alsept and Ellis. He was with the involved in the Black Prisoners Caucus and the Concerned Lifers when he was at the Washington State Reformatory in Monroe. And Stephen Dozier. Stephen works at a Therapeutic Health Services, and he's a case manager with the Royal Program, and he deals primarily with court-involved youth. He was also with the Black Prisoners Caucus and with the Concerned Lifers when both of these gentlemen were at the Washington State Reformatory in Monroe. Welcome to both of you. I'm really glad that we've got you both here in the studio today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Gary.
Well, let's start out. Just tell us your stories. How you came up, where you grew up, and how you both ended up serving time at Washington State Reformatory.
Well, I'm Stephen Dozier, and I was brought up in Seattle primarily. I've lived in Seattle for the last 35 years. I was a high school graduate. I started making a lot of bad choices around my senior year in high school. One of the bad choices I was making was using drugs. Using drugs led me to make bad choices. Those bad choices led me to a life of crime and in and out of prison several times, to the point in 1994 I was sentenced to life without parole under the three strikes law. The crime that I committed was second degree robbery. Throughout my incarceration, for the first few years, I refused to accept responsibility for my acts. I blamed everybody, from the judge to the prosecutor to even the victim. About my third year incarcerated, I started to look in the mirror, and I realized that it was me and my actions that put me there. I looked at the circumstances surrounding, which led to my behavior, which was drug use. So that was the first issue I had to attack. DOC doesn't have a lot of programs. So at first it was just abstinence. And then my next step was getting involved in AA and NA, and eventually the SMART Recovery Program.
Now, when you were incarcerated, was there still access to drugs while you were incarcerated?
Well, it shouldn't come as a shock to any, given the fact that the news media has highlighted on several occasions where correction officers have been arrested for transporting narcotics into the institutions. I'm not saying that's the only way it gets there, but that was the primary source at different times during the time that I did.
Vance, can you give us a snapshot of your story?
Yeah, certainly, Gary. Like Steve, I grew up in the greater Puget Sound area. Went to school, Laurel Hurst Elementary, Nathan Eckstein Middle School, Roosevelt High School. I was, typical average kid, pretty much grew up in a middle-class suburban neighborhood. And at a pivotal age, about 12 years old, as a result of a divorce, we moved to a community that was a little bit lower social class, a lot of wayward kids. And what happened is I found myself in a group of kids that really didn't have fathers or role models, and the family was kind of dysfunctional. And I was, suffering my own identity crisis as a kid who grew up primarily around, white people. And then I found myself in the Black community, and I was really a fish out of water. And so what happened for me is I went above and beyond, and I felt like I had to do more than everybody else. And ultimately, that led me down a path of destruction of drugs and alcohol. And, going to prison really became a rite of passage. It was only a matter of time. I had to go to prison to even run in the circle that I was in. So,
do you think that there was any kind of pressure from people in your neighborhood where you grew up in to be part of this type of lifestyle?
Oh, certainly. I think, Gary, that's what's typical today. I think that's a major crux of the whole problem that we're seeing today with these kids and the whole gang culture. It's peer pressure, and it's this wanting to belong, wanting to feel a part of. And when you're not getting it done in school, you've got to have, every kid's got to have somewhere to go. And if you're not excelling in the classroom, you're gonna gravitate towards those kids on the block. And there is a kind of an unspoken pressure and a need to belong. And so you're gonna do what those kids do because you want acceptance from whatever peer group it is, be it negative or positive.
Talk about the connections between family, education, and poverty, if that applies in either of your circumstances. Did any of those help press you into where you ended up?
Well, with me, poverty never played a role. Both my parents worked. My father was in the military for over 20 years, and my mother worked at Swedish Hospital for over 25 years. So poverty wasn't the issue. It was what pressed me was just the choices that I made. You know, it was personal. I wanted to run. I didn't have to run the streets, but I chose to run the streets. I didn't have to not listen to the rules and regulations of the household. I chose not to. You know, it was all my personal choices that I made. You know, I'm the only child out of five children in our family that ever been arrested by the police. I'm it.
What do you think, Vance?
Yeah, my mother's a college graduate as well, but prior to, you know, kind of gaining some financial freedom, she was a single mom raising me and a younger sister, and we did live in a kind of a lower income neighborhood. I can't really say that I was, you know, poverty stricken, but certainly I was in a single income household. Mm-hmm. And but like Steve, ultimately, Gary, I knew the difference between right and wrong. Mm-hmm. and I allowed my choices to be made by the people that I chose to hang around with, and I want to emphasize chose.
Mm-hmm. Well, how old were each of you when you first were incarcerated?
I didn't have a real juvenile record. I didn't get in trouble as a juvenile. When I was 17 is when I started really reaching out and breaking the law. My first incarceration came at age 18. I went to the county jail for 90 days for a shoplift.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. I didn't have a juvenile history either. But I think around 19 is when I started getting in trouble. And it just started with, you know, minor petty stuff. Mm-hmm. But it became progressive. Mm-hmm. And the worse that my drug addiction became, then that's when the real more serious crimes, the robberies and the assaults and that kind of stuff started to happen.
Well, since drugs seem to be the kind of like the common thread, talk about kind of what was the access to drugs like in high school? I mean, when did you all start getting into drug use and drug addiction? Where did that all begin?
Originally, it was just experimenting with marijuana, and then it led to snorting cocaine, and that
powder cocaine.
Powder cocaine. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the late 70s, 79, 80, 81, that was primarily the usage and using alcohol, mm-hmm. drinking.
What about you, Vance?
Yeah, kind of the same. Marijuana was the gateway drug. Went to clubs and parties and drank alcohol. And at that time, I didn't even recognize alcohol as a drug. Eventually I found the monster, which for me was crack cocaine. And, you know, I was simply uneducated and uninformed about this drug that I was using. And for many, many years, I really didn't even see it as a drug. When I thought about drugs, I thought about somebody shooting something into their veins. And that whole term junkie, I thought that was somebody who shot drugs into their veins and slept on the street corner. And because I smoked and ingested drugs through a pipe, and I drove a car, and I went home every day, I didn't think I had a problem for many, many, many years. I was probably 6, 7, 8 years into active drug addiction before I even recognized that I even had a problem.
Was it same thing for you, Stephen?
I didn't realize I had a drug problem until I went to prison. Until I sobered up. And I don't mean my first time in prison or my second time. I didn't consider it a problem. It was the last time. I knew it was a problem. I could readily identify it was a problem, because it kept leading me to do the same behavior over and over again, and with the same results.
Mm-hmm. Well, what led both of you into, how did you both end up at Washington State Reformatory? What was kind of the end game or beginning game, so to speak?
Well, for me, it was it was a culmination of years of untreated drug abuse and ripping and running and committing petty street crimes to get drugs. And it all caught up with me. And I was prosecuted. I was charged, prosecuted, and sentenced as a persistent offender in 1997. And I did my first 5 years at Column Bay. And then I was fortunate enough to get a transfer and ended up at Monroe, which is a more progressive institution, which is, you know, ironically enough, where I met Steve. And we both actually languished together in the same unit for 5 years, and walked off a life sentence every day for 5 years, never knowing that either one of us would actually ever really be out here.
What prompted them to give you a life sentence? I mean, you hadn't done any extreme violent crime.
Well, I you know, Gary, I don't want to minimize my criminal behavior. I did not have, I guess, what you could call egregious crimes, but I had a couple armed offenses, and I had some unarmed crimes that were considered violent, even though there was no physical injury to anyone. But nevertheless, I was taking things from people that didn't belong to me, and it just wasn't a good thing. And certainly, even today, I won't say that anything I did warranted a life sentence, but I deserved to be sat down, and I deserved punishment, and retribution was applicable.
Mm-hmm. And how, Stephen, you were brought up on three strikes. How did those strikes come about?
Well, in an effort to feed my drug use, I was robbing people, and at times it was snatching purses from ladies. It was shoplifting. It was burglary. It was a variety of different crimes over the years. And that's what led to my third strike, which was a second-degree robbery, in which I took a purse from an undeserving person, you know, which I should have never done, and which I'm sorry to the day for ever doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked about kind of like redemption and salvage. What we and boy, the yesterday the meeting that was really was really impressive, really moving. What led to both of your turning points, if you will? How, you know, talk about what led you to kind of be going in one direction and then, you know, kind of make a shift. And was the shift quick, or was the shift kind of gradual and incremental?
Well, for me, my transformation began about my third year into the sentence, when I accepted responsibility for what I'd done. And I started taking steps to address the issues, what I felt what contributed to me being there, which was drug use. That's when I started to gain some self-respect. because you have to have self-respect. I learned to respect other people. And about that third year in, that's when I started to gain that. And that's when I started to be concerned not only with self, but also with those around me, the younger offenders that were coming into prison. It was disturbing, you know. And me and others such as Vance and other people have, throughout the years, you know, a lot of these kids didn't have fathers, didn't have brothers, and we would reach out to them and encourage them to transfer, to follow our lead.
And Vance, where was it? Is it similar, or where was your big shift?
You know, I can't really pinpoint an actual time. I just know that that something happened. The light came on at some point, and I just knew that. excuse me. I just knew that I had made a mess out of my life, and that, you know, really my mother had raised me better. And you know, every morning I'd get up and I'd look in that stainless steel mirror, and I just didn't like the person that was looking back at me. And I really, at that point, I think what happened for me was I didn't care so much about, I mean, I always, you know, had a longing to want to be free in the back of my mind. I mean, I think every man in prison, you go interview 50 guys at Monroe right now, and they'll all tell you they all have this longing to be free. But I think that what happens for some of us, and I can speak, I think, for a number of gentlemen that we know in the system now, especially some of the guys at the reformatory that are involved in the BPC and the university behind bars and the concerned lifers, I think that there are a number of guys like myself that at some point the light really just came on, and we understood that our actions up until now had been despicable, deplorable, and really, you know, having had some time to reflect, we really wanted to do something positive, even from that subculture, if you will. We just wanted to reach out and try to make a difference and be a part of the problem and no longer a part of the solution.
Oh, you mean be a part of the solution and not a part of the problem?
Yeah. Excuse me. Be a part of the solution and no longer a part of the problem.
Right. Well, let's put this in a small box for a moment. You both were doing life sentences. Do you both feel that it was reasonable or just to both have given you both life sentences for the things you had done? I know you both accept responsibility and recognize the need to reform your lives, but do you think that the courts giving you both life sentences was reasonable?
At the point in time in 1994, I did not feel that I deserved to go to prison for the rest of my life. But looking back now, and looking back at times during my incarceration, I think that when they sentenced me, they saved my life. Because if I'd have kept going down the road I was going down, using drugs, robbing people, disrespecting society, I'd have probably ended up dead. I've probably been a dead man and not be interviewing with you today.
Right.
As far as the amount of time, once I came to accept this sentence, then I started looking at the legal side, the legislative side. Is this sentence proportionate to the crime I committed? No. In my opinion, that's not just a bleeding heart criminal saying that. That's been said by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. They came out in 2000, 2001, and did a study, extensive criminal justice study, and said, no, the crime of robbery in the second degree does not merit a life without parole sentence.
Mm-hmm. You agree, Vance?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, one of my strike offenses, I told someone, give me your money, and walked away from them. And actually, I didn't even go to prison for that. I sat in the county jail for a handful of months. And ironically enough, that was the conviction that I subsequently overturned, which undid my persistent offender sentence. But yeah, I think Steve, you know, really makes a valid point. And he's right. The Sentencing Guideline Commission did, in a comprehensive evaluation, say, robbery two is not commensurate with other strike status crimes. And so when you have a robbery two, and in Steve's case, all three of his were robbery twos with no weapon, nobody, you know, seriously injured. So I'm in agreeance that certainly having had that weight upon me made me look at life through a different set of lenses. And ultimately, I think, is one of the reasons why we're sitting here today and we're able to do some of the kind of things with our lives today that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And just kind of as an aside, did religion or spirituality play any part in this in the transformation for both of you, or either of you?
Well, for me, early on in my time, when I was dealing with the personal issues, you know, I'd pray in my cell. In 2000 and early 2000, mid 2000s, I attended a function in Monroe called Kairos. And during that time at Kairos, that experience, it just brought me to where I am today, to where I'm going to church on a regular basis. I'm married to a woman, my wife, who stuck with me throughout time. She's a Christian, God-fearing woman. And I know that it was through her prayers, through her dedication, through her devotion, that all contributed to me being a free man today. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, most definitely. I belong to the Church of Ecclesia. That is a church that is pastored by Reverend Roy Shorter, who actually does the Black Prisoners. Northwest Connection up at Monroe. But you know, really, what happened for me was more spiritual than religious, and all these wonderful people that God put in my life. And those people, I always saw them as angels, and those people are ultimately the ones who taught me about this concept of love and how we could really make a difference. And, you know, you're one of those people, Gary. You know, I remember early on your involvement in the BPC and just, you know, this selfless act of giving and coming in and volunteering. And that's what I've modeled, and I think Steve has done as well. So, you know, we've modeled our lives after people, you know, like yourself and some of the other volunteers, you know, the Ari Combs, the Carol Esteses, you know, the John Nelsons, you know, these Joe Brothertons.
Well, I have to say, and I probably speak for them too, we were honored to know both of you, and it was just like, oh my goodness, you know, what are these guys doing here? We saw all the change in potential, and we just it was kind of like, how could we not? You know, when seeing you guys. And But that's an aside. It was an honor to help you, and it, you know, it's still an honor to help you, help everybody. But moving along from that, let's shift to politics. I know that both of you received clemency. Is that correct?
No, I came home on clemency. I was
in... sorry, this is Stephen Dozier. Yeah.
Yes, in 2004 or 5, we're connected in more ways than one. Vance had the best lawyer in the state of Washington representing him, working with him on his case. Jeff Ellis is his name. In knowing that Jeff was working so diligently for Vance, I... at one time sat back. I knew I didn't have big financial money. I knew the opportunity of clemency was a long shot, but I wrote about 25 different letters to about 25 different attorneys, you know, explaining my financial situation, which was very limited. And out of all of them that I wrote, I'd get numbers back from 25,000 all the way up to 50,000 telling me clemency is not gonna happen. Jeff Ellis wrote me back and he told me, he said, I would do your case. I've reviewed the facts of your case. He says, I'll do your case for a couple $1,000s. And in doing, wow, in preparing for my case, Jeff took some unusual steps. He reached out to the head King County prosecutor, Dan Satterberg, my sentencing judge, Brian Gain, and also one of the creators of the three strikes law, John Carlson. Jeff orchestrated a meeting for them to come up to the facility to meet with me, to talk with me, to look at my central file, look at my behavior behind bars, look at the accomplishments and the growth that occurred during my incarceration. After that meeting, all of the individuals present said, "Stephen, you should not be in prison for the rest of your life, and we'll stand before the Washington State Sentencing Clemency Board, Washington State Clemency Board, in your behalf." And on December 7th, 2007, they did just that. John Carlson by phone, and Brian Gain by phone, but Dan Satterberg, the head King County prosecutor, in person, alongside my family, my sister and my wife, and a throng of supporters, some of the concerned lifers, sponsors, some sponsors from the BPC even wrote letters, and other community members. And I got a unanimous recommendation for clemency by the governor, by the board. And on May 7th, I had left my cell going to work, and I get a call back to the unit, and the officer tells me, "Call your lawyer." I call my lawyer. My lawyer says, "You want to go home today?" And
I don't even have to ask what you responded.
And I'm telling him yes, and he says, "No, you have to listen to the conditions for your release." And I listen closely, with tears running down my cheeks, because I knew it was through his hard work, and also by God, that this happened, and by courageousness by Governor Gregoire, because she took a risk on me, and it's a risk I forever I carry proudly.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I was released, and I came home, and life has just been good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got a saying that life is good through sober eyes.
How did you come to Freedom Vance?
Well, I came through a different door, but I want to say that I was I was Jeff Ellis's paralegal, so I was there at that clemency hearing. And we helped prepare Steve, and it was an amazing an amazing turn of events, and just to be a part of that. Sometimes when I hear Steve talk about it, I get chills, because I remember going through it, and I felt like we were back in prison together again fighting, and it really felt good to be a part of that and to see him out here. And I remember when he came to the office when he got out. But my freedom came through the judicial door, and I was fortunate enough, after many, many years of pounding my head in law books, I discovered an issue that I later found to be what's called a facial invalidity, and I shopped attorneys as well and contacted Mr. Ellis, and basically presented the claim to him, and he wrote me back and he said, "You're absolutely right." And for a little bit of money, I hired him. He briefed the case. We won. And after some politics, I went back to prison for a few more months, came out, went to work release. And 3 days after I was in work release, Mr. Ellis had me down to his office for an interview. And he hired me, and him and Juanita Holmes and Steve Witchley hired me, and I was hired by the firm of Ellis Holmes and Witchley, and I've been a paralegal there ever since, and that was just over 2 years ago.